Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of October 2018. Welcome to episode 41 of this podcast series. The concept of the show was to just have a brief chat about all the comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this sort of the books that I read during October. Technically, it's the books that are listed in the weekly blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com from October. Now, I regularly repost those on my Facebook and Twitter. You can find those, but those posts are not spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. And here, it's a little more review, a little more critique, and a little more feedback. But first, a little feedback. And I mean that literally. A little feedback. Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom and DCOCD podcasts complimented me for continuing to get these episodes out on schedule. You're like clockwork with these, Professor. Thank you for noticing, Paul. I try. Retweets and likes and shares for that last episode came from Gene, the podcasting machine Hendricks of Two True Freaks, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Nathaniel Wayne from the Council of Geeks, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Paul Hicks, Old School Ross, Chris from Bat Books for Beginners, and Laurel at Mountain Flower One from the Feathers and Foes podcast. And on to the books I read last month. As I do on this show, I'm categorizing the books that I read, and first are those that I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books, or an upcoming appearance on Back to the Bins. I read the book that Paul Spataro suggested, Amazing Spider-Man 103, and I brought Wonder Woman 294. Now, related to that, I read a handful of other Bronze Age Wonder Woman books, Wonder Woman 252, 278, and 303. Of these WW books, for the most part, I like the Huntress backups the best. Consistently, they were the best part of these issues. I tend to prefer the Helena Bertinelli version, but it was fun revisiting the Earth 2 version of that character, Helena Wayne. But the highlight was issue 252, which featured Diana Prince as a trainee astronaut, with one of her co-trainees being Mike Bailey. I Twittered that fact out, and Podcasting's Michael Bailey himself thanked the artistic team for taking a few pounds off of his likeness. I think it was Zoom Yukinori of the Done in One Wonders podcast, Wonders Show of Podcasterly Wonder, who pointed out that this version of Bailey looked a little bit like Superman. So clearly, as far back as 1979, they were homaging the future king of Superman podcasters. And comics I read for listening to podcast. I am caught up now on all of the shows on Aaron Moss's Headcast network, all the different shows he does. And I happen to see for cheap some of the issues that he'd be covering on upcoming episodes, including a bunch of Manhunter books from the dime sale. So I read Manhunter 19, the next part of the Sinners and Saints, I think that's backwards, Saints and Sinners storyline, to read along with episode 20 of the Starman Manhunter Adventure Hour. And on to the new comics that we read right off the shelves. Adventures of the Super Sons 3, Superboy goes head-to-head against some kryptonite and splits into Superboy Red and Superboy Blue, which means Damian is subjected to twice as much super abuse as usual. But that does make for three heroes to battle the gang, a pack of alien kids cosplaying as villains under the direction of Rex Luthor. In this issue, we learn a bit about Luthor's techniques in assembling his team, and surprise, it's not very benevolent. And the surprise final panel arrival, which I won't spoil till next episode, definitely whet my appetite for next issue. Green Lanterns 55 through 57. This is the end of the series, with this as the last storyline. And in it, solid comic book professional writer Dan Jurgens is giving us an interesting spacefaring story of mysteries within the GL Corps, including the possible betrayal of the Corps by Simon Baz, but Jess doesn't believe that. And all of that leads to a battle against Hank Henshaw, the cyborg Superman. As I said before, I was not in love with expanding the series beyond Simon and Jess, but I think that this storyline has to do with the future of GL and the Corps in the upcoming DCU. In terms of a final wrap-up, it looks like Jessica Cruz might be out of the DCU for a while, but I really hope she comes back and is well used again. This was probably my favorite Rebirth title, excepting this last story arc at least. And these days, you do have to say, 57 issues? That's not a bad run for a title. Justice League Dark 3 and 4. We make some progress on the whole magic is dying front. With some help from John Constantine, of course, Swamp Thing, and a magically powered Wonder Woman. In issue 3, we get some Zatanna flashbacks, adding a bit of character backstory to her. And in issue 4, we advance the plot pretty far too, with Wonder Woman getting that magical power and going up against Hecate. At least that's how I'm going to pronounce it. This is part of the Witching Hour storyline. I really like the lineup in this particular series, which includes Detective Chimp, Dead Man, and Man-Bat. Good characters and a pretty decent storyline. So I'm looking forward to where this is all going. Wonder Woman, 55 and 56. 55 ended the first storyline written by Steve Orlando, and I was not a big fan of it. This one resolved the battle in Karak, leaving Atalanta to work with Faruka. There were a couple of nice moments where we saw inside the lasso of truth, or a visualization, what happens when someone is under the sway of the perfect. That I don't think I'd seen before. Now, issue 56 is another part of the Witching Hour story, with Swamp Thing being added to the team. And it has the best dialogue of the month from the mouth of Detective Chimp. Brace yourselves. There's no telling how weird things are about to get, says the talking chimp, driving the boat full of monsters. I saw somewhere that G. Willow Wilson is picking up Wonder Woman after this crossover ends, and I like those first few trades of her Ms. Marvel, and there are some similarities between those characters, so I do have some hope for the title, and I'm looking forward to the change. And on to the general comic reading that I did, and we start by welcoming a new person to the hashtag comic book circle of life. And that is Dr. Anthony the Engineer. He's in a very nice care package recently, and I read a bunch of those books, including Aberrant, number one, from Action Lab's Danger Zone line. This one features a military unit tasked with taking out powered individuals, known in this world as Aberrants. And in this issue, the leader of that unit is invited to join the super elite, super secret Article 13, who keeps tabs on all the world's Aberrants. So good setup, good premise, and we meet a couple of interesting characters. An intriguing first issue. And Dr. Radar 1 and 2. This is the complete series, and it was a pretty good one at that. It's from Titan Comics and definitely has a European feel to it, which makes sense when I learned that it's a translation of a 2014 French comic. It takes place in 1920s Paris with a gentleman detective who is a bit Arsène Lupin and a lot Sherlock Holmes. A number of scientists involved in rocketry and travel to the moon, remember this takes place almost a century ago, get bumped off by the mysterious Dr. Radar, and nobody has a chance of tracking the killer down except for Ferdinand Strauss, our detective hero. And the art needs to be mentioned here, as it is very heightened, and the coloring is also dramatic. These features make it occasionally a little hard to follow the story, to distinguish every character from the others, but the story was definitely worth whatever effort it took on my part to attempt to understand it. and from reigning Listener of the Year, Dr. Ange. I read the collection of one of Howard Chaykin's early works, Iron Wolf. These originally appeared in three issues of Weird Worlds in 1973 and 1974 until a space-based fantasy series. You've got royalty, vampires, damsels, some in distress, but some in complete control, and a roguish, swashbuckling hero. Chaykin did the art and plotting with Denny O'Neill doing the scripting, so it is a definite talent-packed team. Good story, really enjoyed it. But last year, I ran across some She-Hulk books, and I liked them so much that I declared that if I ever found more for cheap, I'd pick them up. And so I did. From the dollar bins at Half Price Books, I read Sensational She-Hulk 31 from the John Byrne era. She's fighting Scrag the Living Mountain. But that really doesn't matter, because the story is light and funny and self-aware, and all of that worked for me. My favorite part is when the geologist turns an electric generator into a rocket, which stumps She-Hulk's buddy. But the green one explains why that's not really a problem. He's a comic book scientist, after all. Remember, Hank Pym started out as an entomologist and ended up building robots. And She-Hulk 5, which I picked up for a quarter at World's Greatest Comics, is from the 2006 Dan Slott run. There's not as much self-awareness here, but we do get some lawyering from Jen, and that's always good. This fun issue also had the Two-Gun Kid, who, since because of modern laws, was the No-Gun Kid for a little while. That was the best part of the issue, getting the kid settled into these modern times, including the final scene where he gets a suitable replacement for his horse. And this one I picked up when Half Price Books actually had quarter bins, meaning this one, DC Superstars number 1 from 1976, has been in the stack for a while, because it's been years since they had quarter bins at HPB, at least around here. This was one of the titles that my aunt had at her house on the lake in upstate New York when I was growing up. Maybe this exact issue. I don't remember that, but I certainly read it somewhere along the line. This reprints Teen Titans 11 and 24 from 1967 and 1969, respectively. One has them beating up robbers who somehow have access to a remote-controlled monster thing, and the other has the Titans helping out a Native American friend, which is always shaky 50 years later. But fortunately, Bob Haney characterizes every character as odd and weird and nonsensical, so I think he gets a pass on treating the Native American in that way. But between these two stories, Haney does drop some amazing teen lingo, none of which I'm sure was ever uttered by any teen ever. But that's not a problem, because these are fun, fun stories. From the five for a dollar bin at Heroes Con, I picked up an issue from Slave Labor Press, Neo Men number 1 from 1987. I believe the series ran a whopping 2 issues, although information about this title was a little hard to find. It was a black and white sci-fi story from the 80s, and I've read a decent amount of black and white sci-fi stories from the 80s. And let me say, after reading this issue, that many of those other black and white sci-fi stories from the 80s were lots better. And from the highly caffeinated Clinton Robinson, I received a copy of, from 1995, a book that is so 90s-ish that it glows. No, the cover of Avengers The Crossing is so glossy and slick that it does pretty much glow. The inside, which was the start of a storyline, was just not great. It's the kind of book that drove Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks right out of the 90s comics retrial podcast and into the waiting arms of YouTube superstardom. Clinton also sent the supersized Namor 50 from 1994. He is in all of his glory in this issue, fantasizing reasonably about his love for Sue Storm. Now, you might think that since my main man, benefactor, Dr. Doom, also has strong feelings for Miss Storm, that I would not approve of this potential pairing. Well, here's the thing. Let's say that there are 5 billion people in the world who are of the appropriate age to date and eventually marry Miss Susan Storm. Of those 5 billion, my preferred order for a life mate for Miss Susan Storm is number 1, Victor Von Doom. Number 2, through 2,499,999,999, nearly every other man on the planet. Number 2,500,000,000 to 4,999,999,999, every woman on the planet. Just that there's no evidence that this would be Miss Storm's preference. And finally, in last place, number 5 billion on the list of people I'd like to see date Miss Storm is Reed McStretchy Buttface Richards. So Namor is definitely way higher on the list than, you know, that guy I just mentioned. So all things considered, the official Latverian position on this potential coupling is it's better than many of the alternatives. Speaking of professional buzzkill Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks, I read Supreme 25. As I said on Twitter when Nathaniel sent me that pack of actual, legitimate New England Quarter books, I thought he was a kind and generous fellow. Until I read this one. I'm not saying he hates me, but if he did, this is the kind of book that he would send me. Now, Bex from the Redeemed Otaku podcast looked at the cover and commented, "I don't even know what's going on with his arms." I answered that those were extreme 90s muscles. Tom Panarese of Pop Culture Affidavit commented, "Ah, 90s comics, forever circulating like currency." I will point out one factual bit about this issue. Supreme 25 was one of those Images of Tomorrow issues where they jumped into the future and produced issue 25 of their titles in May 1994, even though their titles hadn't gotten to that number yet. In the case of Supreme, this came out between issues 12 and 13. And to give this title credit, they did get to 25, which I'm not certain that all of the Image books eventually did. So good on them for that. Soraya was Joe recently said in a parcel of books, including Venger Robo 6, a manga-style book from Viz from 1994. The premise was fine, I suppose, a sci-fi-style story about pilots defending the world. But the style of the action, the art, it was just not for me. I've read some manga that I like, but most of those were not in the action-adventure genre. Joe also sent me the middle issue of a 5-part series from Alterna, The 12, number 3, and that's The 12 as an XII, just so you know. I think that the one drawback I found with the Alterna books is directly related to their singular great advantage. The newsprint allows them to be priced at $1.50, but it also, I think, does not take to the coloring process as well as modern comics do. So reading a bunch of these, you do start to notice that. The books try to take advantage of that, like this one does, using shadings and colorings that are available to their best use, to try not to do more than they can with the paper that they have. But the books are just not as bright and vibrant as other titles. That's not necessarily a bad thing, or even necessarily a big thing, but it is a thing. Sir I Was Joe also sent a big book, The Nom Magazine number 2, which reprinted issues 3 and 4 of the series. The black and white of these issues really shows off Michael Golden's art in particular. This is a series that got off to a really good start, and so these early issues are pretty solid. The books sent in by the great Kans and Gregorujo of the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast included Whodunit, number 1 from Eclipse Comics. First, a few cool things about this book. It was a mystery story, in this case, a cold case from Las Vegas that involved versions of Marilyn Monroe and DiMaggio and Sinatra and that crowd. and I like mystery stories in any form, including comic books. This also offered a prize to a reader who could solve the mystery by the time the next issue hit the stands, and it was produced by Mark Evanier and Dan Spiegel, so it was, you know, technically quite solid. The problem with this, as opposed to, say, The Maze Agency, another great detective comic book, is that because of that contest, they did not reveal the solution in this issue. In real time, you had to get the next issue to get the solution. And there are two problems with that. One, there's no guarantee that 35 years later, you have access to that next issue. I didn't, but the internet gave me the answer. And two, this title only ran 3 issues, so a full 33% of the mysteries presented in this comic book were never solved. I'm not saying if you dislike me, send me Whodunit 3, but if you ever send me Whodunit 3, I'll kind of assume you dislike me. Fair? Also from Greg, I read one of the weirder Big Two books I've ever read, Gross Point, number 1. From DC from 1997, a family moves to the strangest town around, and things get very strange very quickly. Now, some of the kids' books that I read, some from the generous Canadian Rob Lance, some from the cheap bins at World's Greatest Comics, and some from Sir Iowa's Joe, include Archie 3000, 10 and 16, Archie and Me, 155 and 158, Jughead 241, and Uncle Scrooge 71. Archie 3000 was an interesting idea, but those stories were very wonky and not always in a good way. Archie and Me is a fun title, focusing very heavily, pun not intended, on Mr. Weatherby and his relationship with Archie, usually in school, but not always. And Uncle Scrooge, as per usual, was quite solid, an adventurous, globe-spanning story. I talked earlier in the summer about the first 2 issues of a comic that was sent to me for review by the author, and well, for whatever reason, Sam Johnson followed up by also sending me a PDF of Geek Girl Volume 2, Number 3, Part 3 of the Crime War storyline. The issue, written by Johnson, with art by Carlos Granda, picks up right where Issue 2 left off, which is to say that Summer, the most recently second person to wear the Geek Girl power glasses, went up against the supervillain Chromex without the glasses. It's not a spoiler to say that she does get out of that mess, but she does get into a tussle with Neon Girl at, ironically, a celebration of the first Geek Girl Ruby. There are fight scenes in here at the start of the end of the issue, and those are good, and those are necessary, I suppose, in a superhero comic, but the strength of this title is in the interactions between the mostly female cast of this book. I think he gets the self-centeredness of all folks at that age, the idea that everybody is the star of their own story. That is portrayed and written really well. I mentioned something similar about issue 2, that Johnson really gets the awkwardness and tensions of relationships between young people. Those conversations always seem authentic, and that's not easy to do. Geek Girl number 3 is available to order through the Geek Girl Kickstarter, which ran during the month of October and was successful. You can link to that at geekgirlcomics.com. The single issue was published by Marcosia in the UK and is available at their site as well. And the collection should be out in a few months. All right, time to take a break here, and when we come back, I'll talk about graphic novels, trades, miniseries, and thematic readings that I did during October.
You're listening to Satellite Sisters.
What's a satellite sister?
The person you call when the best thing in your life happens or the worst.
The person that gets you up, gets you going, and gets you through.
And every once in a while, changes your mind.
This podcast is part pep talk, part weekly check-in.
Like grabbing coffee with a friend.
Thanks for being here. Welcome to the Satellite Sisterhood.
I've got some sad news. Avocado toast It may have run its course.
It's toast?
No.
It's toast.
Julie, you went to see a movie this weekend, so we don't have to.
I'm Leanne Dolan. I'm a writer and producer. I live in Pasadena, California. I'm the youngest sister. I have two boys of my own, a husband, and a big dog.
Does everybody know that you lived in Russia?
It's a data dump of royalty news.
You know, we're coming at you, Facebook.
Reluctantly. Healthy eating and exercise, not fasting and dieting, remain your best bets. Damn it. Darn.
I'm Liz Dolan. I'm the middle sister. I'm an on-again, off-again corporate executive, and I live in Santa Monica with my dog, Hooper.
Are Pop-Tarts a form of ravioli?
And
stay noisy, next gen.
It's just a pleasure to be in two countries that appreciate coffee that doesn't include whipped cream.
From the West Coast to Sydney, it's really only three or four movies and a nap. And
I'm Julie Dolan. I'm the oldest sister. I've lived and worked all over the world. Now I'm in Dallas, Texas. I'm an empty nester and an urban nana with five grandchildren.
New mom pep talk.
My hobbies and activities. Sloth is is what it says.
Are they just voracious on the reef, or will they bite us?
Oh, did I tell you he was eating our paycheck? No. We're...
Is that our piece of the pie this
That's
month?
Our piece.
Okay. So, National Sibling Share Your Wealth Day. Get off the table, Hooper. Yeah.
Maybe that lettuce had like one last day on the before it expired. Just take the lettuce.
There is silence. They're not calling back. Or as my son Will said, his text messaging system was broken, which is a lie.
I mean, I guess if a smoothie here is $20, that it does make sense that an actual IV would be more expensive.
Everybody just wants to see a Nemo.
Yeah.
You know, and
like the U.S. Army trumpet brigoon or something.
I don't think that's the right plan.
I think it is.
I'm like 100% sure.
It's a trumpet for good.
You can listen to new Satellite Sisters episodes weekly on all podcast apps, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, NPR One, and Google Podcasts. Or find us online at satellitesisters.com.
And don't forget, call your satellite sister.
And we're back. And let me say this about that promo that just played. Because I know there is very little overlap between the relatively geeky listenership and the Satellite Sister listenership. But I will say two things. One, I've been listening to the sisters for more than 15 years. And let me say this to the gentlemen in our audience who do make up the majority of the relatively geeky listener base. One of the things I've learned in my 5+ decades on the planet is if you want to figure out what makes those alien creatures tick, you know, female, women, human people, listen to them talk. But back to the comics. And around this time of year, I do like to do some seasonal reading. And around this time of year, that means Halloween-based horror comics. First up from the batch of comics, and then a while back by the generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance, most of these are falling apart, which is Rob's specialty. And I say that with deep affection and appreciation. But from that pack, we've got Werewolf by Night 22. And I have to admit that it's hard to think of a better story engine for a monthly comic than a person who on the full moon, you know, once a month, turns into a monster. I mean, we do get a few pages about what happened to Jack Russell during the month, but the bulk of this issue is about the night before the full moon, and the few days after. And then a dramatic cliffhanger. Jack gets arrested on the last page for murder. And Chamber of Chills 25. This one starred He Who Haunts the Jungle Night, Mumba. And this monster came pretty darn close to taking over the whole world, but you probably don't remember that because of the memory wipe that Mumba did to the entire planet just as he was flying off into the airless reaches of the universe. Not a bad story, actually. And the backup, a 5-page Twilight Zone-ish tale about the Flying Dutchman, was solid as well. And Universal Monsters, The Mummy. This is a 48-page prestige format one-shot from 1993 from Dark Horse, which is an adaptation of the classic Universal movie. If I have ever seen the movie, it's been so long ago that I have no memory for the plot details, so I can't speak to that aspect, the accuracy of the adaptation. But that being said, it was a pretty good comic book. Tragic, adventurous, dramatic. A good read. And Ghosts 33. A couple of pretty decent backups, but a really strong lead story, The Hangmen of Spectre Island. A man who escaped prison more than 10 years before returns to the now-abandoned prison, since he figures they'd never look for him there. But when he does get there, he finds that all of his past victims are waiting for him. A really good ghost story. Sir Iowa's Joe sent a seasonally appropriate miniseries a few months back, and he even sent the whole thing, which, as you know, is not always his move. But I was grateful to be able to read from Zenoscope Van Helsing versus Frankenstein 1-5 from 2016. This is part of an ongoing, like a series of miniseries featuring Liesl Van Helsing. And even though I hadn't run across her before, this was fully self-contained and explained really everything that I needed to know about the character. In this mini, she has to take on a monstrous version of a good friend's husband who has been converted by his wife, Liesl's buddy, into a monster. He was in a terrible accident, and the wife wanted to save his brain and upload it to a new body, and this patchwork monster was just intended to be a stopgap measure. But that's not the way it turns out, because in this kind of story, that's never the way it turns out. Good action, good character stuff, and good old-fashioned monster hunting. And since it's Zenoscope, I do have to mention the art, of course. And similar to the first few trades of Grimm's Fairy Tales, which are the only other Zenoscope title that I've read a lot of, like those first few trades, the covers are by far the most cheesecakey, most good girl, most pinup of the art in the book. The interiors, I suppose, are a bit more sexy than the average comic, but not nearly as much as the covers might indicate. Sir Iowa's Joe also sent three books from last year's Halloween Comic Fest event, The Mighty Thor, Hellboy, and Grimm Tales of Terror. The Thor one wasn't all that Halloweenish, except that it featured Hela, the goddess of death. This was a reprint of a Walt Simonson story and had Beta Ray Bill, so it was definitely a good read. Hellboy may have been the best of the batch about a story about a witch who was hanged and then really wasn't all that happy about that. And the Grimm story was the creepiest, about a boy worried about the boogeyman under his bed, although that might not be, in fact, the scariest thing in his life. From the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics, I picked up House of Mystery 239 and 246. A couple of these were pretty good, even pretty scary, like Day of the Witch, which ended in a devil baby sort of twist. It was 1976, and that was sort of an in thing. The best of the batch in terms of these stories is probably Death Vault of the Eskimo Kings, which, in addition to having an awesome title, also had a very Twilight Zone-y sort of ending, a you-get-what-you-deserve sort of twist. And from the 3-for-1 box at Comic Town and from Sir Rob Lance, I read Phantom Stranger 3 and 32 from the late 60s and early 70s. The first had the Phantom Stranger actively involved in the story, actually going up against Dr. 13 the Ghostbreaker, in a case that involves a Phantom of the Opera style of spirit. Or does it? In issue 32, he had taken the role more of narrator, not nearly as active a participant as he had been before in a case involving an evil witch. Or does it? And that one also had a pretty good Black Orchid backup. Overall, a pretty good batch of creepy titles and scary stories. I'm sure I'll read a few more over the course of the year, but I'm going to save a bunch too, so I can read a bunch next October. And now, moving away from the Halloween time reading, I plucked out of the bins at half-price books a couple of books with a certain Latverian hero on the cover, and proving once again that that quartet in blue may need Doom in their book. Doom does not need the FF. I read Thor 603 in the follow-up issue Thor Giant Size Finale. These are from the JMS run from 2009. I am inclined to give JMS the benefit of the doubt on most things. But that said, these ones had a little too much Thor, if you know what I'm saying, and not quite enough Doom. I mean, I liked the overall setup. Thor in exile, Baldur on the throne, most Asgardians relocated from Broxton to Latveria. This enables Doom to do some noble experiments. Let's go with that. On the willing Asgardians to learn the secret of their immortality. So he could get some of that immortality himself, which you have to admit is a pretty noble cause. But like I said, all of that good stuff aside, these two Thor books seem to have a lot of Thor and Asgardian stuff in them. That was kind of weird. Now I have to confess that my bookkeeping process failed me on this one, as I can't remember who sent me from the 2016 volume, Volume 4, Love and Rockets 1 and 2. I have not read a lot from the Hermanos before, but obviously they are legends. I don't mind slice of life books or books that just generally don't conform to American standards, expectations of what comic books should be. And even though this is the start of a new volume, obviously a little more familiarity with the characters and their relationships and backstory histories would have helped me with these. I enjoyed them to the extent that I understood them, and I recognized the quality, but based just on these two, maybe I've learned that these are not the books for me. We mentioned earlier Dr. Anthony, the engineer. After hearing a recent quarter bin series about Dial H for Hero from Adventure Comics, Dr. Anthony sent in 8 issues from a related New 52 series. I like those issues so much that I got the rest of the title from Hoopla, so I read Dial H 1 through 15. These were written by award-winning fantasy author China Mieville, whose biggest novel is probably Perdido Street Station. And in this series, he took the concept of Dial H and really broadened it. He added additional dials, including an S dial for Sidekick, and a Doom dial. Mieville also really leans into the telephone sort of aspect of this, adding the operator as a character and the exchange as a sort of HQ for the dials, really trying to create a backstory for the crazy concept of the H dial, which was just Silver Age silliness when it was created. But of course, the secret to Dial H is the character creation. And although these are not reader-submitted, but created by Mieville, there are a ton of winning names. Many of these do need the visuals to get the whole effect, but here are some of the characters I really dug. Blink Centurion, Moon Monkey, The Flummox, Rock, Paper, Scissors, and the Bristol Bloodhound. And the very cool character, Open Window Man. Seriously, he was pretty cool. And he did bring back the villain Abyss. That was fun to see. The narrative wasn't totally clear all the time, but it was an audacious attempt, and I give Mieville full credit on that. And I give DC credit for giving him this title to do something totally wild with. I'm glad I read it. Thank you, Dr. Anthony, the engineer. Sir Iowa's Joe sent a bunch of comics in, including every book from the Epic Lines Shadow Line imprint, and I read the whole of one of those titles, Dr. Zero, 1 through 8. The whole line is about a small society of powerful beings who had lived for millennia unnoticed by humans. But by the end of the 20th century, they were forced out into the open, among them the most powerful of all, Dr. Zero. He has the power to effortlessly manipulate humanity, and does so in ways that are not necessarily benevolent. It's a pretty good series that tackles some interesting questions about the interactions between powered beings and the rest of us, with a little bit more real-world version of what that would be like. For example, the U.S. military attempts to capture Dr. Zero because he is a threat to national security. That makes sense to me. Spoilers, that plan doesn't go all that well, however. So although there are some dated elements, and the book appears to be trying too hard sometimes to be hip and relevant and different, it's not a bad series. Joe also sent The New Exiles 1 and 5. Now, as you may know, I'm more of a DC guy than a Marvel zombie. And then within Marvel, the X-World is pretty much an unknown quantity to me, even the classic Chris Claremont stories. So there was pretty much no reason for me to enjoy these. And although I didn't have much context, I liked the writing, although the art was a bit too extreme for me. And even though this was from 2008, there were enough 90s-ish elements that these didn't totally work for me. From Hoopla, I finished up a crime series by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips that I started last month, Kill or Be Killed, 11 through 20. I saw on Facebook, I believe it was Andy Leyland, who posted that he had also just read this series and really dug it. I raved about the first 10 issues last month and read the last 10 this month. Dylan spends a lot of time in this batch of issues in a mental institution, based on confessing that he sees a demon who tells him what to do, which, if you remember from last episode, was to tell him to kill one evil person every month, or the demon will come for Dylan himself. This batch of episodes also wrestled with the idea of Dylan's visions being imagined or part of a mental illness as opposed to being real. The book is first person, so mostly you get Dylan's waffling back and forth on this subject, although the book itself does seem to weigh in a little bit on that question. It's not 100% clear, at least in my reading. And that ambiguity is one of the strengths of the storytelling, to be honest. It's a great premise, great story, great characters, a really great comic book. We say on this network, one of our catchphrases is that endings are hard. And even though Brubaker pulled one sort of unfair trick, the nature of the story did give him permission to do so, I think. And the endings for the plot, for the character relationships, were wrapped up very well, I thought. And even though the series does wrap up with issue 20, the hint of what is going to happen with the characters after the end of the story, that is also very intriguing. Brubaker and Phillips are among the best in the business in telling this kind of story, gritty, street-level crime stuff. And in Kill or Be Killed, they are absolutely at the top of their game. Also on Hoopla, I continued with a series I talked about last episode, Gotham City Sirens 14 through 19. I like the ladies of the Bat family and have quite enjoyed this series. Poison Ivy has taken over the botanical division at Star Labs, specifically to redevelop an abandoned project that had to do with reforestation. The project was abandoned because the results were, let's go with, unpredictable? Zatanna shows up for a couple of issues, and those were interesting for a few reasons. First, she and Poison Ivy evidently have had a very bad past. Those ladies plain don't like each other. Whether that is official, like ongoing backstory, or something just conjured up for this storyline, I don't know that, but it worked really well. Also, the reason that Zatanna is here is also interesting, which is to remove Catwoman's knowledge of Batman's secret identity. And that's interesting because even though this is 8 or 9 years old, this plot point involves the love affair between Cat and the Bat, which is a main plot point now here in 2018. So I liked seeing that sense of continuity. And also Talia shows up because she believes she has some claim also over Bat's heart. Very entertaining stuff, to be honest. I have enjoyed reading this title. There are a few more issues of it left to be read, and I look forward to knocking this out next month. Another series I continued with, the aforementioned Grimm Fairy Tales 31 through 36. This was a nice collection of stories, including a follow-up on the Ugly Duckling story from the last volume. But the highlight was the two-issue Pinocchio riff, which was pretty darned dark. Dorian Gray was also dark, but that did not have anything unexpected in it so much. If you know that story, you knew what was going to happen. But the Pinocchio story, and I guess also Puss in Boots, both of those took me by big surprise. Very dark and very good. I continue to enjoy this series. And another of my Hoopla finds was a seasonal collection, Pep Digital 25, Halloween Blowout. What I like about these collections is how many times they've done the same basic premise, such as Veronica's annual Halloween party, or the competition between B&V for the best costume. But they do different things with it each time. And in this one, of course, they did manage to do different things, again, with those premises. And Sabrina obviously has a few appearances as well. And though she's not my favorite of the side characters, obviously, for a Halloween book, she fits pretty perfectly. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, individually, some of the horror stories were good. She-Hulk 5 was quite entertaining, the one with Two-Gun Kid. Dr. Radar was really intriguing. But like last month, there's a clear top pick. And it's the same clear top pick as last month. Killer Be Killed continued to be great. Not good, but great. And as for my favorite individual issue, I'll go with Killer Be Killed 18, where the detective that's been on his trail has actually figured it all out, even though another man has been arrested for all of those murders. Next month, I'll be reading another series from the Shadowline saga and wrapping up Gotham City Sirens. But I'll also be reading a ton of war books, which I do every November in observance of Veterans Day. Rest assured, whatever I do end up reading next month, I'll talk about it here, and that episode should be out at the end of November or early December. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.